Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Daily Premier League action and reaction. This is Football Social Daily.
Welcome to Football Social Daily. Good to have you with us. If this is your first time, well, you've come to the right place for daily updates on everything Premier League. There is a new episode of this podcast every single day, offering insight and opinion on the latest news from the English top flight. Get yourself subscribed to the show so you're always up to date with the latest. Also, if you want to listen to the latest news on your team, you can get updates via your smart speaker now. Just ask to open Sports Social and you can get an update on whoever it is you support in the Premier League. There is more information on that, as well as more news, at sport-social.co.uk. But on to the business of today's podcast. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the Premier League bending its rules for Manchester United just three games into the season. Should we all be getting outraged at such favouritism? We'll decide later. It does involve a certain Mr. Cristiano Ronaldo. Also, if your team stopped one of its star international players from taking to the World Cup qualifiers this week, then maybe you should be worried. You could have to do without that individual for a while, as the likes of Mexico and Chile take objection to you withholding their stars. And of course, we're going to take a look at England's professional display last night as the Three Lions dispatched Hungary with ease in the first of their three World Cup qualifying matches this week. To do all that, I've got Niall McCaughan on the podcast today. Morning, Niall.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Marley.
Morning.
And that's Marley Anderson. Right, let's get to business. Let's start with last night's victory in Budapest for the Three Lions, which puts Gareth Southgate's team a step closer to qualifying for the World Cup in Qatar. It was Hungary nil, it was England 4. Do England deserve a lot of credit for this one, Niall? Because Hungary were pretty impressive in the European Championships. They didn't offer much going forward, but they certainly contained teams at the Euros. And here we've got an England team who sometimes have struggled to break down stubborn defences, bagging 4. It was a decent display.
It was a decent display, and actually, in all fairness, I caught the second half of the game, and I'm glad I did, because by all accounts, the first half wasn't anywhere near as exciting. Yeah, I was out playing seven-a-side football myself, and then came back for the second half, had my spaghetti bolognese and a glass of red wine, and watched England put some racists to the sword. It was quite a pleasant watch, actually, to be honest. I'm sure we'll get onto that in a little bit, but you're absolutely right. I think in terms of the on-field things that Hungary have been able to achieve in the last few months, they impressed during the Euros, and although they finished bottom of their group, it was a group that included France, Portugal and Germany. So in all fairness, you can't really complain at finishing the bottom of the group when you have got those other sort of power hitters in the pool alongside you. But they will be disappointed with the way that they fared against England last night. I think they would have fancied it on their own soil. 60,000 raucous fans inside the Puskás Arena in Budapest. And it was a professional performance from England. And once again, there were questions when the team news dropped about Gareth Southgate. Why is he playing two holding midfielders? I thought Declan Rice, and especially Calvin Phillips from what I saw, was absolutely outstanding yet again. And I just think that, you know, this guy, Gareth Southgate, has led us to our first major final in international football since the 60s. And there are still people that think he doesn't know what he's doing. Can you not just at least trust him now that he's got us to the Euros final? It might not have been a vintage passage to the final. You know, I know we didn't play a great array of teams, which is the excuse that people use in the World Cup, but we beat who was put in front of us and got to the final and fell at the final hurdle on penalties, thanks to some, you know, young players who probably couldn't deal with the pressure as well as maybe they should have done. And they'll learn from that. And I think this is the start of something for England. They've kind of got that bond and they've got that kind of camaraderie, and they're the most likable group of England players that I can remember. I think they do deserve credit for the way that they dispatched Hungary, because that's what it was. It was quite convincing, and really 4-0, I think, probably flatters Hungary a little bit. I think it could have been 6-7, could have been more. England created plenty of chances in the second half, and that's credit to them, because we discussed on yesterday's Football Social Daily whether there could be a possible hangover from the Euros. You look at Italy. Last night they drew one apiece. I think Spain lost last night to Sweden. So, you know, you're looking at these international sides who have had reasonable Euros, and not all of them are getting the job done. But England did. They topped the group. They're 5 points clear in Group I in the World Cup qualification group. You can't really ask for much more than that. Clean sheet to boot. Well played, England. And moving on to the next game against Andorra at the weekend.
It was probably one of those results that was more important to kind of move on from the Euros than it was necessarily to get the result itself, because there will be plenty of time to catch up had it gone wrong in Hungary. But it was a very professional, very convincing result for England in the end, Marley. As Niall said, finished 0-0 the first half. Did you spot any signs in that first half that this could potentially turn into a rout?
Not really in the first half. I mean, there was barely anything to talk about, to be honest.
There was a single shot on target for either team in the first half, was there?
No, I think the best performance came from whoever was in the highlights truck trying to produce something from that first half to talk about, to be honest. But we see that a lot with England. You know, they flatter to deceive in the first half, and then they find a gear and find what they're trying to do in the second. Maybe they get a rocket up them at half time and you know, shout it out a little bit and G'd up a little bit. But
you can't imagine Gareth Southgate delivering the hairdryer treatment, though, can you?
No,
I think he's more an arm around the shoulder type manager. He's a come on, Harry, you can do a bit better than that type, rather than shouting in his face.
Yeah, it's I can't see him booting boots at people like Fergie did back in the day. But it's whatever he does, it seems to work, doesn't it? So it's great for England to go out and put a very, well, horrible atmosphere to punish them, sort of thing, and you know, send them away, even though there was no England fans there, to put a smile on England fans' faces, and get the weird atmosphere out of the way with a convincing win.
What did you make of Declan Rice? Niall said he thought Declan Rice and Calvin Phillips were excellent at the kind of holding, the pivot, if you like, is the modern term for the role they play in this England team. I'm really biased about Declan Rice. I think he's a fantastic player. He got the goal at the end, which I think the Hungarian goalkeeper will be very disappointed he let squirm under his body. But I thought Declan Rice had another really important game for England. I think he's becoming a vital player to England's midfield. And what frustrates me as I see England fans constantly questioning what he brings to that team. But was last night's performance one of those performances where you're left in no doubt that he is important for Gareth Southgate and the way he sets up?
I am absolutely not on the same page as anybody who can't work out what Declan Rice brings to a football team. It makes no sense to me how people can't understand what he does. Like, he's the one that wins the ball back the most out of anyone. Like, if you're going through midfield, he will put his foot in. He won't just, like, jockey you and try and push you into the safe position. He'll get his foot in and he'll try and win the ball back. And I think that's huge. And, you know, people say, why do we play two holding midfielders against a poor team? Well, number one, they're not that poor a team. They played poor last night, don't get me wrong, but they're not that bad a team. And number two, their best player is their attacking midfielder, Dominic Szoboszlai, and he plays in that half space behind the striker and in front, sort of behind our midfield. So you need someone who's going to take take control of him and track him and tackle him when he gets the ball and close him down and all the rest of it. That's why Rice and Phillips were in there, because their formation had two attacking midfielders. So by rights, you need two defensive midfielders really to stop them getting at your back four, your centre backs. So that makes perfect sense to me. Also, if you want to play 4-2-3-1, you have to have two defensive midfielders. If you want to play, you know, Bellingham, he probably doesn't play as deep as Phillips and Rice. He probably plays slightly more box to box. That's not
A 4-3-3 in the middle of a three.
Exactly,
most likely.
Exactly, it's not suited to the system. So once you pick the system, you almost have to pick Phillips and Rice, and they were fantastic in the Euros. They've never put a foot wrong for England. What's the issue?
I think they play really well together, don't they?
Yeah, exactly. And what I will say, and you might disagree with me as a West Ham fan, I think Declan Rice is better for England than he is for West Ham. And hear me out on this. The reason I think that is because he's showing and standing out amongst better players. And I think that England have better players than West Ham do, and I don't think that's an outrageous statement to make. Which leads me
how
to...
dare you?
Yeah, exactly.
How dare you?
After Masuaku is on his way to our offices right now.
Which leads me to think that imagine if Declan Rice had better players around him at club level. And that's not me to say he should leave West Ham. I mean, he's one of West Ham's best players, if not their best player. But if he's still standing out in an England team, which includes the likes of, you know, Mason Mount and Harry Kane and Raheem Sterling et al., then just how good could he be? And I think that that is a valid question. I actually think I prefer watching him for England. I think alongside Phillips, they just complement each other so perfectly. And actually, it leads me to question how good Declan Rice could be if he had, you know, elite talent around him. I know he's been linked with Chelsea. Chelsea have decided to go for Saul Niguez on loan, haven't they, from Atletico Madrid. But, I mean, an English midfielder learning off of some of the best other midfielders in the world, like if he had gone to Chelsea, he would have been learning off Conte and Jorginho and players like that. And I just think this guy has got plenty of potential, still only in his early 20s. Very likeable character. I'm really excited to see how he gets on in the future.
It pains me to say it, but I think his future lies away from West Ham because, as you say, you only have to look at Harry Kane at Spurs. Like, you don't want a player who is one of the best in the world in their position, which I have no doubt Declan Rice will grow to be. You don't want them to see them finishing their career without any trophies. And that means, I mean, as much as I love my football club, we're not going to be challenging for the Premier League anytime in the next
million years.
Yeah, exactly. I was gonna say million years, but then I wasn't sure whether that would be underestimating enough. Yeah. Speaking of Harry Kane, what did you make of his performance last night, Niall? Because he didn't have a shooting boots on, I don't think. He got the goal, which I thought really unfairly was described by the commentators as a poacher's goal. And I don't think a diving header can ever be a poacher's goal, the amount of skill and accuracy that has to go into a diving header. But he did get the goal, but he also missed three really big chances that normally you'd expect Harry Kane to gobble up. It was almost as if, and I don't know whether I'm creating a narrative that isn't there, but it was almost as if he had other things on his mind considering what's happened over the summer.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that because he scored a few goals for Spurs, hasn't he, already this season, whether that be in European competition or not. I still think that that's relevant. And I agree with you about the poacher's goal. I mean, he anticipated the ball dropping at the near post. And if you watch the replay of the goal, there's at least three Hungarian players who are just left in his wake. And that's unusual to say that about someone as slow as Harry Kane, that a defender's been left in his wake. But certainly that was the situation. And, you know, he anticipated that 3 or 4 yard, you know, radius around the apex of the 6 yard box at that near post, you know, area, that near post region, and he diverted the header beyond the goalkeeper. I thought the goalkeeper was poor for three of the England goals, actually. I think he probably could have saved that Harry Kane header, but it was direct, it was powerful, and again, Sterling kind of tried to drive the ball across, and I think it might have taken a deflection off the defender, fired into the ground and skipped back up again, and he just anticipated that the ball would drop there. And I think that that is the sign of a really good marksman, is someone who knows where the ball is going to drop in those dangerous areas. The three Hungarian players had no idea where that ball was going, but Harry Kane did. So for his goal, I think you have to say more skillful than it is a poacher's finish. It wasn't like, you know, he was kind of waiting for a rebound or a tap in or anything like that. he really did anticipate where the ball was going to drop and he made the most of it. But I will say, with the other chances you refer to, there were a couple of times where Harry Kane got in those positions where we've seen him score time and time and time again in the Premier League for Tottenham, and he missed. I mean, there was one where he hit straight at the goalkeeper. There was another couple of opportunities where you thought he should really be scoring that. And actually, in the Euros, Harry Kane running through on that, you're thinking, goal, every time. And I was last night when I was watching, I was thinking, that's a goal. And it never materialised. Thankfully, England had enough in the tank to smash four past Hungary, thanks to some poor goalkeeping as well, as you say. But yeah, definitely Harry Kane. Not a vintage performance from him, but he still scored and had plenty of chances. And I think that just goes to show the quality of England and the quality of a player like Harry Kane, that even though he's missed three or four gilt-edged chances, you know that you can just write it off as a bad day at the office, didn't have his shooting boots on, whatever cliche you want to use, because you know the next time that happens, he will be burying those chances. So I don't think it's an endemic problem with Harry Kane. Just think it was one of those things where, you know, unfortunately for him, he missed those opportunities and yet still grabbed the goal. So yeah, an unusual performance from Kane, out of character, I suppose you could say, but I don't think that's of any concern for Spurs or England.
Also a demonstration of England's strength and depth as well, I guess, that your main man, your front man, is not getting the goals, he's not taking his chances, and still you manage to put four past a decent opposition. It kind of shows that you don't, as an England team, we don't need to rely on a Harry Kane or whether it was a Wayne Rooney or whoever it was in the past, which is real progress for us as a national team. We have to talk about, I don't want to talk about it, but we have to talk about the booing of the taking of the knee at the start of the game, the racist abuse that some of the black players on England's team received during the game, the cups that were thrown by the Hungarian fans onto the pitch as well. It's scenes that we've seen time and time again, particularly, unfortunately, when teams from the east of Europe visit teams, teams from the west of Europe visit teams from the east of Europe. What's there left to do here, Marley? I mean, stadium closures don't seem to work. We've seen that action from UEFA before. So what steps can be taken by FIFA this time going forward to kind of hammer out this racism that is still very prevalent in football on an international basis?
That's a $1 million question, isn't it? I don't know, to be honest. Other than chucking teams out of tournaments, it's kind of, you're always going to lose, really. They're always going to be there. They don't care whether people think they're in the right or wrong. That's what they want to do. That's how they're programmed to boo everything that calls for equality and all the rest of it. I'm sick of talking about it, to be honest, but it keeps happening. And as well, with the only being home fans at the game last night, it was even louder. There was no even like comeback from any England fans because none of them were allowed to travel. So, I don't know, points deductions, chucking teams out. But the way things are going now, you know, if you start doing that, you're gonna have no one left in tournaments. You're gonna have eight team tournaments because it happens in all kinds of countries over there. We've seen it in Bulgaria a couple of years ago. It's happened in obviously thingy last night, Hungary last night. It happens in Romania, all these other places that are over there. So, you know, what do you do? I don't know. It's a bit of an unwinnable situation for me.
I don't want to get too political on this, but Hungary is, in my understanding, quite a right-wing country. And their prime minister, not too many months ago, I don't think, basically lobbied for the creation of what he called a new European right-wing force for our type of people, in quotation marks. That is scary discourse. That is scary discourse from the leader of a country who is using terms like our type of people. You know, you don't need to be a specific type of person to play football. And if you love the game and you enjoy the game, whoever's playing the game shouldn't bother you. And I don't think we saw that on display last night in Hungary, which is extremely, extremely disappointing. And to be fair, I mean, I question some of the values of brands that we see. And I know this is kind of diverting down a bit of a rabbit hole away from football, but the Hungary national football team, their kit supplier is Adidas. What are Adidas going to do about what they saw last night? Or are they just going to do nothing?
Yeah, that's a great point.
Because Adidas are a huge brand, one of the biggest sportswear brands or just general brands on planet Earth, and their brand is associated with an occasion, an incident, a football team, a national team, who have now got this reputation, or maybe already had that reputation, for not being inclusive and welcoming. And does that align with Adidas's brand values? I think it's a valid question.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I don't think it's one that has been raised very often, but any football team, international or at club level, has huge investment and huge deals with the likes of Adidas or drink sponsors or food sponsors, whoever it is. And it's probably up to those brands to take action. And that is something that can physically hurt a national team and will cause them to take action. I think it's a really valid point that. I think what we have to say as well is it's quite easy to point fingers at these Eastern European nations where the trouble does tend to be coming from, because they are less diverse populations. There are a lot of right-leaning governments in that part of the world, and go, oh, what are they doing? They're doing it wrong. How dare they have this attitude towards players? But there is an element of, we need to get our own house in order still as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, Jim.
Because
yeah.
look at what happened after the European finals. We are by no means...
Absolutely.
I'm not sure whiter than white is the right term to use in this scenario, but you get what I mean.
Yeah.
It's a problem. It's a footballing problem. It's a society problem. It's not just a problem with these nations.
Yeah, I agree. And I think Gareth Southgate even basically paraphrased exactly what you said in a way in his pre-match press conference when he was asked about the possibility of, you know, racism and racial abuse from a section of Hungarian supporters. I think he said, yeah, we need to look at ourselves first. We need to get our own house in order, because as you say, this country is far from idyllic and far from correct in terms of the attitudes that some people have. And, you know, we can sit here and condemn as three white blokes, you know, a bunch of other white blokes being racist. But there's the old saying that people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. And I definitely think that I'm with you in that one, in the sense that we need to try and address the issues we face in the Premier League and much closer to home before we start really pointing the finger at others. We can point the finger and say, it's wrong, you shouldn't do it. But we should be setting examples rather than effectively accusing someone, you know, pot calling the kettle black, so to speak.
FIFA have announced they are going to launch an investigation into the incidents. I mean, that's one thing. It's great they're taking some kind of proactive action. These investigations often lead to minimal fines and very little action. So we'll wait to see actually what FIFA decide will be the punishment, if any, for Hungary after that behaviour in Budapest.
Just to end on a slightly more positive point, did anyone see Pat Frost, the England kitman's tweet yesterday?
No.
No.
After the game, he said, by the way, we lost six balls in amongst the ultras and they were buzzing. They thought they were nicking our balls, but the Hungarian FA gave us them for the warm-up, so they nicked their own balls.
Fair enough. Well, that's a good, a positive note to start. Well, actually, is it a positive note? I don't know. Anyway,
I quite liked Declan Rice and Raheem Sterling drinking out of the beer cups
Jack
that they've been pelted
well.
With. I really enjoyed that. Yeah, that was good.
And I worried about that, though. What if someone's... in one
COVID
in a COVID time, why you wouldn't drink someone else's drink right now, would you? I definitely wouldn't.
There's a great
especially
picture
off a bunch of racists.
There's a great picture of after the first goal of Declan Rice drinking from one of the glasses that have been thrown onto the pitch, and then you've got some of the England fans in a huddle, and you can see Harry Kane's kind of being the teacher. He's pointing at Declan Rice kind of with a stern look on his face. Put that down! Stop that now! It's a great little picture. I think one of the things we have to say is England reacted well to the scenario. The cauldron of hate, they responded the best way they can in that scenario, and that is on the pitch. England didn't have any problems with players not being released for this game, but there were certain Premier League clubs that did withhold players from international duty, and that could cause repercussions down the line. We'll talk about it next on Football Social Daily.
Football Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode. Football Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk.
Welcome back to Football Social Daily. We're in the midst of the World Cup qualifiers, a load of international games taking place. Some players were released for those international games and some players
weren't, and that could spell trouble for English clubs, Premier League clubs as well, who could now be banned from picking players that they failed to release for international duty for this round of the World Cup qualifiers. So far, Chilean, Mexican and Paraguayan football associations have all contacted FIFA to complain that they were denied access to players, including Wolves' Raul Jimenez and Newcastle's Paraguay midfielder Miguel Almiron. So that's a small sample at the moment of players that have had complaints launched about their availability. That could grow as more of the football associations from around the world get involved with this potentially. I guess it kind of holds up questions about who has access to these players, who is responsible for the well-being of these players. And I guess at the end of the day, Premier League clubs pay these players' wages, Marley. So is it not their prerogative that if they feel they're being released into a situation which isn't good for the player, that they can keep them, can prevent their services being provided to the national teams?
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it? Because, you know, where does the power lie here? You know, as you say, they don't get paid by international football. It's more of an honour and something you want to do, and everyone sort of, I think you get a match fee or something, but half the time it goes to charity or whatever. So, I don't know where I stand on this, because I think if you're safe enough, you should be all right. But there doesn't seem to be any like allowance for, like, the way I see it. You can travel anywhere you want, as long as you test there and test when you're back and you're negative twice, then that's fine. But you know, clubs are looking after themselves, because they're the ones that, you know, they've got to pay them. So you can understand it from that situation. You can also understand it from a player's situation, that they'd love to go and play for the country and help them, because that's what you dream of as a kid, especially the South Americans.
I mean, you've got to assume someone like Miguel Almiron, for example, that he would have been in agreement with the club that he didn't go, because a club's not going to put their relationship with a player at risk by withholding him from an interview.
I'm not sure that's true though, Jim, because I think some of the reaction we saw from players like Edinson Cavani, for example, at Manchester United, I think it came out of the blue. I think it really did come out of the blue, to the point where, you know, I think Cavani, I mentioned on the show before.
What was the reaction from him? I didn't see that.
So he posted on his Instagram with just a bunch of question marks. He screenshotted the statement from the Premier League and just posted a bunch of question marks. And, you know, Manchester United are unsure whether they're going to be able to have Cavani, because Uruguay have got international fixtures this month, next month, November, January, February and March. And every time he comes back, presuming Uruguay stays on the red list, he's going to have to quarantine for 2 weeks at a time, which means that actually you're talking 12 weeks of the season, 3 months, he's not going to be available for Manchester United. Now, that's a huge, huge blow. So actually, I don't think the players were entirely clued up on this situation, to be honest.
Well, how do you feel about it then, Niall? In that situation that you just highlighted, you've got Manchester United who are forking out, what, 3 months for a player with no access to him. We're talking about at least £500,000. Probably over £500,000 in wages for a player they can't access.
Yeah, I understand that point of view, but also I think I mentioned this before as well, that especially in South America, playing for your national team is more important than playing for your club side, regardless of where you get paid from. I think Edinson Cavani feels more fire and passion playing for Uruguay than he does for Manchester United. And that's not to say he doesn't put in the effort when he plays for Manchester United, because he absolutely does. I mean, Miguel Almiron is a perfect example at Newcastle. The guy runs his socks off. You know, might not have the best end product, but he'll put in a shift. But also, you know, you could argue that he feels more valued and more pride when he plays for Paraguay. And I think that's totally understandable. I mean, his affiliation to Newcastle United is the fact that he got signed by the club and he's paid by the club and they're an employer. It's slightly different when you play for your national team, who aren't an employer. It's got far more sentimental value to you as a person, I think, especially to the South Americans. So I think it's a really tricky situation. It's a bit of a minefield, to be honest with you. I can understand why clubs have vetoed allowing players to go to red list countries, because much like the Cavani situation, if he has to quarantine for 2 weeks at a time, you're basically paying for a player that won't ever play, which is just a disaster. Especially for someone like Manchester United, who could do with Cavani's experience and know-how and ability. So I definitely think that there are questions to be answered here. And I think it's such a shifting landscape, because it does it not all depend on what the UK government say? And, you know, if the UK government say, OK, we're taking France onto the red list, that means Paul Pogba will have to stay at home. You know, it means that all the other players that play in Europe, for instance, you know, if they put Germany back on the red list, all of the German players like Timo Werner and Kai Havertz at Chelsea, they'll, you know, have to stay. They won't be allowed to go. Or if they do go, they'll be missing for 2 weeks because of a quarantine. And, you know, and I just think that it makes the situation difficult. And it's a tough one to really put your finger on what the priorities are. Because for someone like Edinson Cavani and Raul Jimenez and all these South American lads, playing for Mexico or Paraguay or Argentina or whoever is the pinnacle. There is nothing better than going home, seeing your family whilst you do so, playing for your national team, being lauded as a hero. There's nothing better than that for those boys. You know, I don't care how many goals they score in the Premier League. That is their zenith. That is their pinnacle of their career. But for others, it's not quite as important. So it's a really difficult one to put your finger on, to be honest with you. And it's, I don't think it's any surprise or any shock, let's just say, that the South American nations are the ones who are really the most annoyed about this.
Mm. I mean, these are unusual times. This isn't Ryan Giggs having a mysterious injury and not being able to play in a Welsh friendly game. This is really unheard of. I mean, it's a global pandemic, so it's going to be slightly different. And clubs have a right not to put their players at risk. For example, most footballers have a clause in their contract saying they can't go skiing because skiing is a dangerous sport, could result in a leg break, could put them out for months. Surely it's a similar thing with allowing players to go to red list countries, Marley. If it's not just the fact that potentially they have to come back and isolate, there's the potential that if you go into a red list country, there's a reason that country is a red list country. It's because COVID is prevalent and it puts the player at risk of contracting COVID.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Why, you know, why not just test, though, when you get back? Like, you know,
it's not just the player, though. It's the staff who work at the football club and everyone else. I mean, you've got to... the staff inside Old Trafford are more important than Edinson Cavani playing for Uruguay. And he might not see it that way, but for me, that's the priority.
But that doesn't stop you getting it in the first place. I mean, Niall's got a point that you don't want to spread it amongst the football club, but the same, you don't want an asset. You don't want an asset getting COVID. And we've seen, although we don't know what the risk is to, like, a professional footballer, are they less at risk than someone that's probably like you and me isn't quite as fit? I don't know. But a lot of these players haven't been vaccinated as well. I think there was a few Premier League clubs released their statistics on how many players in their squads had been vaccinated. And the numbers were around 70-80%, which is reasonably high. But they're the clubs that are willing to share that information as well. So you've potentially got unvaccinated individuals going to countries where there is high risk.
Well, yeah, but how often are they, you know, you say they go to the countries with a high risk. They're not walking around the streets, are they? They're training. They're training, they're in a hotel, they play a game, they come home. So it's not like they're going to delis and cafes and restaurants and stuff. Like, you can stop them doing that if you say, you know, if you come to international football this week, you know, we need to create like a bubble and stay safe or do everything we can to stay safe. And then you maybe don't have to quarantine because we know exactly where you've been at all times. But, you know, if you are letting them out wandering around, then you can't, you sort of take that risk even more. So I don't know, it's a tough one, this, because, you know, everyone's got a genuine sort of point, but money talks in the end, and the club seem to have the power. But I feel sorry for Almiron, because it's the one time he gets to play with good footballers.
What do you think the likely outcome will be here? So these international football associations have lodged a complaint. They're asking for players who haven't been released to kind of face some kind of ban situation to be withheld. I guess probably for the same period would be the logical solution. So, right, you've not had this player, so we're not going to allow him to play for what would have been the isolation period. Do you think that's what we're going to see happening? Or do you think this will be a kind of slap on the wrist, warning shot situation?
It's such a minefield, Jim. I have no idea what the outcome is going to be. And to be honest, I'm surprised that clubs didn't fear a backlash or come up with some sort of contingency plan amongst the 20 clubs, because this was a unanimous vote, by the way. Everyone voted in the Premier League, all 20 teams voted to push this through, to not allow international footballers to be released if they're on red list countries. And actually, it's a logical response if you think about it. It's a logical response. But actually, in terms of what it means sentimentally to someone, you can't ever analyse that or assess that because you're not that person. And I think it is such a minefield. I think, you know, it's an ever-shifting landscape and it's impossible to give an answer which makes sense and that pleases all parties. So I think it all boils down to the argument that should we even be playing international football at this point of time anyway, with the way things are going? You know, with the Euros going the way they did, I think that kind of basically removed the veil of international football being a difficult thing to undergo during coronavirus times. You know, because the Euros went through and were completed pretty easily across the continent and no one was really worried about that. There wasn't really a great deal of COVID cases. If I remember rightly, during the Euros, there were no kind of whole teams wiped out due to COVID cases. And I think because that went relatively smoothly, all things considered, I think now that kind of thought process that international football isn't really appropriate in the current climate, I think that's gone. I think that ship has sailed, and I don't think we could use that as an excuse anymore. So it's really difficult. I mean, it's just the nature of the beast is that the Premier League is the most watched league in the world. It's a global league with fans all across the earth, in different continents, in different countries. And with that, you're going to get players that are attracted to play here. And that is the situation that the Premier League finds itself in. In terms of an answer, it's so difficult to put your finger on what the right answer is. I mean, if Jimenez wants to play for Mexico, who are Wolves to say, no, you can't play for your country? It's just one of those things where it's impossible to get right. And I will watch this one with interest because I think at the end of the international break, when players start coming back, I think people will forget about it again until a couple of months' time when we have the next international break, and then these questions will start popping up again. So I do wonder what the answer is.
We'll wait to see what action, if any, is taken. You can find the latest news on the Premier League, where that action will be reported, at sport-social.co.uk. After all, rules were meant to be broken, and that was certainly the case with Manchester United and the Premier League, who have broken their own shirt numbering rules in order to hand Cristiano Ronaldo the number 7 shirt at Old Trafford. We'll talk about that next on Football Social Daily.
Football's Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk. Football's Social Daily. Subscribe to the podcast now so you never miss an episode.
Welcome back to the final bit of today's podcast, and we're going to talk about Manchester United and Cristiano Ronaldo, who has got his legendary number 7 shirt back at Old Trafford. The Premier League have broken their own rules by allowing Manchester United to give him the number 7 shirt after the start of the season, when it had already been assigned to Edinson Cavani, which they are not supposed to do. The exact wording in the Premier League handbook says, before the commencement of each season, each club shall allocate a different shirt number to each member of its first team squad. Whilst he remains with the club, a player will retain his shirt number throughout the season for which it was allocated. In other words, you can't swap numbers halfway through a season, which is exactly what has happened. But this is more than just a shirt number being swapped. Marley, what does this mean? What does it tell us about how important Ronaldo is at Manchester United and how important Ronaldo is commercially to the Premier League?
Yeah, I think that's what it comes down to, the brand Ronaldo, how much eyes and how much shirt sales are going to be on, like made as a result of this decision. Strictly speaking, you know, would this happen for any other team and any other player? Well, maybe Messi if he came to the Premier League, but I'm not sure. You know, if Joe Willock demanded the number 4 shirt and at Newcastle, and Matty Longstaff didn't want to give it up, I'd very much doubt we'd be going to the Premier League knocking on the door saying, "Can you bend these rules for us?" So from that, yeah, I mean, you can take it as one rule for one and one rule for another, if you like, but ultimately, you can see why it's been done. It's, brand Ronaldo is one of the most commercially attractive players in the world, despite his past. And it's something that I think was always going to happen, to be honest. As soon as Daniel James left, and Cavani wears 21 for Uruguay anyway. So, you know, it was always going to happen, I thought.
Why do people care about football shirts, though, Mark? I mean, you're a Newcastle United fan. You've got the legendary number 9 shirt at that football club. I think probably that's one of the most iconic shirts in the Premier League. Do you really care who has it on their back? Do you think players really care what number they've got on their back?
Yeah, I think everyone cares. It's hard
do
to
you?
Sort.
Do you genuinely care who's got the number 9 shirt?
I'd love to say no, but I actually do. less so now. When you get older, I don't know what it is. It's hard to put into words and not sound like an idiot when you're saying it, because at the end of the day, it is just a piece of plastic on a shirt, you know. So I don't know, but there just is something about that, you know, when legendary players have wore certain shirts, and when legendary players carry shirt numbers around with them, as is Ronaldo, as is Messi. You know, Shearer at Newcastle, for example. It's just, I don't know, it's just something that feels right and amongst football fans, players, and clearly it goes through everyone because they become synonymous with that number. And then, I don't know, it's hard to put into words and sound like sort of get it across to someone who doesn't understand it, because they're ultimately providing the logic to it. Like, it's just a number. It literally doesn't affect your performance or anything. Like, it physically can't. But mentally, it's a different thing. And, you know, Ronaldo wants a number 7. Fine. I remember he got unveiled at Real Madrid with the number 9 shirt because Raul was still there. And then he had to wait a year or two before getting the number 7 shirt there. So I couldn't see that happening again. Once you've scored 700-odd goals in your career, you know, it was always going to happen for him that they shifted the rules a little bit.
It does kind of show, I guess, how the Cristiano Ronaldo transfer came out of the blue for Manchester United, because if there had been a sniff of this 3 weeks prior, surely they would have made some kind of contingency plan for withholding that number 7 shirt and changed Cavani's shirt number going into the season beforehand. So it shows that it did kind of come out of nowhere, this one. In terms of that red number 7 shirt, Niall, obviously not everyone thinks it's as iconic as maybe Manchester United fans do, in particular former player Angel Di Maria, who said this week, "I don't give a f*** about the Manchester United number 7 shirt," which is the shirt he wore at Old Trafford. "At first they talked to me a lot about it. It was just a shirt. My problem at Manchester United was the coach, Van Gaal, was the worst of my career." So this is an interview in the Mirror with Angel Di Maria, who isn't the most popular person at Manchester United nowadays, I don't think. I mean, there's a lot to unpick there in that statement, I think, just a few words that probably means a lot. But does it kind of hint at maybe part of the problem as to why Di Maria's career at Manchester United didn't work? Because he didn't really get Manchester United. He didn't get the club's history, which is an important part of playing for that football club.
First of all, if he doesn't care about the number 7 shirt, why has he got it tattooed on his arm?
Has he?
Yeah, the
I didn't know that.
So, I mean, there you go. There's your first question. Answered. I just think that's... I think he's bitter.
He's very bitter.
I think he's
yeah.
bitter that it didn't work out at Manchester United. And let's be honest, not a lot of things did work out at Manchester United under Louis van Gaal. I think they won the FA Cup and sacked him the morning after they beat Crystal Palace. So actually, you know, in all fairness to Angel Di Maria, you know, he was part of an era at Manchester United which was almost doomed to fail. You know, straight after Sir Alex Ferguson left the club, David Moyes took over. You know, and David Moyes is still in a way bitter about how things ended at Manchester United. I mean, he always mentions how he doesn't feel he had enough time. And these things cut deep, because Manchester United is a historical old club, one of the biggest in the world. And I think that Di Maria, along with several others who have flopped at the club, do feel that sense of regret and bitterness that they didn't succeed. And I think that's all it is from Di Maria. I think he was absolutely desperate to get out of England. I don't think he liked the climate. I don't think he liked the culture. And I think that was evident in the way he played. And, you know, he lasted a season and he was gone. And he might blame the coach, but at the end of the day, he wasn't good enough. And it's as simple as that. And he's gone to PSG, won silverware. You know, he's won French league after French league after French league. Now he gets to play with his old mate, Leo Messi. So, you know, actually, at the end of the day, he's enjoyed himself, Di Maria, since he left Manchester United. But I just don't think anyone has ever pined for him to come back to the Premier League. He's a good player, But even when he's played against United, there's been, I think, one or two occasions where he's put in good performances. But he's not been, you know, outstanding to the point where you think, oh, United should never have sold him. You know, it's just not one of those things where you look back on with regret if you're a Manchester United fan and go, oh, wish we never let Di Maria go. I don't think any other club has been interested in him since he left Manchester United because he was that poor. So definitely think that there is that's laced with bitterness. Think it's foolish that you would make that sort of comment when you've got the number 7 tattooed on your arm. So I definitely think that there is elements of that. I think that, as you say, it highlights probably exactly why he wasn't a success at Manchester United. If he can't appreciate what the number 7 means at Manchester United and the players who have come before him and the responsibility that results in, it is only a piece of cloth with a number printed on the back, as Marley says, but for some clubs it means more than others. So for my team, Portsmouth, we don't really have a number that means anything significant. I think that a lot of the time now as well, you get people referring to numbers as positions. So we know that a number 9 is a striker, a number 10 is an attacking midfielder who plays in behind the striker, an 8 is a box-to-box midfielder, a 6 is a more defensive midfielder. So actually we use numbers nowadays to kind of describe positions. But for teams like Newcastle United, whose number 9 was made legendary by Alan Shearer, who scored the most goals of any player in the Premier League of all time, and the number 7, who was, you know, which was worn by George Best, one of the best players of his era in the 60s, Cantona, David Beckham, Cristiano Ronaldo, you're talking about greats of the Premier League and of Manchester United. And in Ronaldo's case, one of the best ever to play the game. So actually, if you can't appreciate that you were a number 7 wearer at Manchester United, then you don't understand the football club. And I think that's exactly the point that you're trying to make there, Jim. So yeah, lots of questions over Di Maria's response, but I think it just makes him come across as a bit bitter and a bit twisted over his exit.
Let's finish on a contentious issue then. What is the most iconic shirt number in English football for a particular team? Is it Manchester United's number 7 shirt? Is it Newcastle United's number 9? I mean, the obvious answer is it's West Ham's number 16. With that's worn by the great Mark Noble, but
oh, it's number 6 for West Ham, Bobby Moore.
Yeah, cool. Well, of course it is, but I mean, that's a retired shirt as well. But yeah.
Well, there we go. I mean, that's just
that's in English football, that isn't the most iconic shirt. I struggle, as and it pains me to say, I struggle to see a more iconic shirt than that Manchester United number 7 shirt for exactly the reasons you listed.
I think Bobby Moore 6 is as iconic as it gets
from an English point of view.
He's won the World Cup, he was the captain of the England side that won the World Cup. That photo of him lifting the Jules Rimet on everyone's shoulders. And I know you can't see the number 6, but that's one of the most iconic photos in football. I mean, there's a statue of it on Green Street in East London. So I would argue that, to be honest.
I mean, it was before 1992 or whenever the Premier League launched, so it doesn't exist because that's when football started for a start. But I mean, it's a good shout. And
in the Premier League era.
I don't know why I'm arguing against it.
In the Premier League era, I see why you mean 7. I can see why you'd go for that.
Marley, can you argue that Newcastle's better?
I think it's cute that you're both arguing about that when it's clearly Newcastle's number 9. So it's, yeah.
Do you know what? This question...
I win.
Can you just give me a list of the Newcastle number 9s since Alan Shearer?
Didn't Carroll have it last season?
No, Carroll bizarrely had number 7 last season.
Oh, did he?
So Callum Wilson's got it this season. Last season it was Joe Linton. Brilliant.
Yeah. that iconic number 9 which was inherited by Obafemi Martins when Alan Shearer resigned.
Yeah, I think it was Martins, and then I think Cissé took it after Martins maybe.
It was Carroll then Cissé, I think.
Was it Carroll then Cissé? Then Cissé left in about 2016. So,
I've got a list here, Marley. I can tell you. So it went Shearer, Martins, Andy Carroll, Papi Cissé. Then it went to Dwight Gale, and then it went to Solomon Rondon, and now it's with Wilson.
Big Rondon. He should have had it for years as well. We should have signed him, but. There you go, he's at Everton. I might support Everton, you know. They've got Rafa Benitez, they've got Rondon, they've got Andros Townsend, who we should have signed back in 2016-17. So, yeah, might jack it in and get a blue shirt instead of a black and white one.
I think this feels like a debate that should be on our Twitter account later today, Marley, in terms of the most iconic shirts in the Premier League. I want to see if anyone can argue against Bobby Moore, Alan Shearer at Newcastle's number 10, and that iconic 7 United shirt. So at the Sports Social, you can find it there later. But that is it for today's Football Social Daily. Niall, Marley, nice one.
Thank you, boys.
Thank you.
There'll be a brand new show on this channel tomorrow. We're going to be talking to ex-professionals from the beautiful game every single Saturday morning, discussing everything that's coming up in the Premier League weekend. Obviously, there are no Premier League matches this weekend, but they'll be talking about club issues and, of course, England's next World Cup qualifier, which is on Sunday, Andorra as well. So The Dugout, our brand new show, starts on this feed tomorrow. Make sure you've hit subscribe so you get that episode as soon as it's ready. And we'll see you next time on Football Social Daily.
Football Social Daily. Find more great sport at sport-social.co.uk.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.